So let me start by saying that today we're going to build a toolbox of things that will be useful for you guys next week and in the following weeks. And in particular, we're going to build some tools that Catherine is going to use to study the superstring. So you guys will have to wait to learn what type 2A and type 2B superstrings are until next week. Okay? We're not going to do it today. Rather, today we're going to study the conformal group in D dimensions. And then we will move on to set D equals to 2, where something very special happens. Okay? So what is a conformal group? In any manifold where you can find a diffeomorphism that will take the metric to be as flat as possible, meaning it would look like the flat metric, okay, where the dot here means if you have Lorentzian signature, or it means this if you have Euclidean signature. And as flat as possible means that it's almost flat except for a scale factor that can depend on the coordinates. Okay? So any manifold whose metric can be brought to this form is called conformally flat. Now suppose that you have a conformally flat manifold. What is the set for the subgroup? What is the subgroup of diffeomorphisms that will preserve the form of the metric? That's the question we would like to answer. Is the question clear? If you perform any crazy preparametrization or any crazy diffeomorphism, you will certainly change this form of the metric, right? Now, we would like to ask, out of all possible diffeomorphisms, what are the diffeomorphisms that we can perform so that once we found this metric for our manifold, we stay with a metric that looks like that? The conformal factor can change in any way you like, but we would like to keep this form. Can anyone tell me something that we can do to our, some change of variables that we can make so that the metric will keep this form? Well, explicit, can you give me any explicit change of variables that we can make? Sorry? Yes, that definitely will work, yes. But anything else? Any subgroup, any group that you know that will act on the X space and will keep this form invariant? The Lorentz group, excellent. So the Lorentz group is a subgroup of our conformal group, okay? The thing we're looking for. In fact, more is true. What happens if you perform a translation? It should also be fine, okay? So Poincaré should work. What else can you do? Yes? Sorry, all you're doing is a change of variables, right? And you can see what happens to your lying element, and your lying element will perform exactly the same.
I mean, you're changing like your coordinate system, but you're not changing the variables.
Here we're talking about diffeomorphisms. What do we mean by a diffeomorphism? You take right? This map will keep us in the same manifold. What we are doing is changing coordinates. It's a change of coordinates. Well, a general change of coordinates. That's what we're doing here. Okay? A general coordinate transformation. What do you do in GR? When you say that GR is general covariant, that you want to write equations that are, what's the transformation that you keep in mind? Isn't this? No? Okay. Well, but in order to define our conformal group, what we want to do is to find transformations on the coordinates that will keep the form of the metric invariant. The conformal factor can change, but this structure, we want to keep it, to preserve it invariant. For sure, these transformations will do that, right? Because they keep this form invariant. Now, any other thing we can do to our chain, to our coordinates? Yes? Well, you know, reflections are all part of the Lorentz group, right? So the Lorentz group has different components. Well, we can do something else, right? If we want, these ones preserve this part, but if we want to change the conformal factor, all we have to do is to perform a scale transformation. Okay? What do I mean by that? You can take your variables and scale them by a factor x mu. That will change the metric for sure, but it will change it in such a way that the transformation can be reabsorbed into some factor of this form, and we will still keep our conformally flat structure manifest. Okay? What else can we do? Well, the next one I have to tell you, because the next one I don't expect you to guess, because it's not very intuitive. The next one is called an inversion. You can take your coordinates and send them to something like this. You see, it's called an inversion because you are divided by the norm of the vector. So in a sense, imagine that you're doing the Euclidean case, so you're sending the origin to where? The origin of the coordinate system is sent to where? To infinity. And you're bringing infinity to the origin. So this, strictly speaking, works if you think about your manifold as something where infinity is a point that is included in the manifold, okay? Because under inversions, it will get swapped with the origin, okay? Now, it turns out that this is not the end of the story. There is something that are called special conformal transformations, which are even less intuitive than this one. Okay. And what are they? Well, they are not very difficult to describe. All you have to do is to use inversions and translations. You perform an inversion. Okay, so you take your x, you send it to x mu divided by x squared. Then you perform a translation by some vector v. So you take your new object y, okay? This is all you're doing. And then you perform another inversion. Okay? So what do you get? Well, you just take this new thing. We can call it, well, you won't try, I don't want to call it Z because we're going to use Z later on. But you take this thing and plug it into here again. And what you're going to get is something that looks like x mu . Okay, so this all looks very, very strange, right? But we're going to see that all these transformations are going to combine into something very beautiful. The way to see it is by looking at the infinitesimal transformations. And what do we do? Well, everywhere we see something that depends, any transformation that depends on a parameter, we take the parameter to be very, very small, right? To be infinitesimal. So in the case of the Lorentz group, remember, we take x mu to go to some matrix times x nu, OK? That's the Lorentz transformation. Have you ever studied the infinitesimal action of the Lorentz group? OK, excellent. OK, that's pretty good. So you will know that infinitesimally, the Lorentz group will look something like this, OK? Where if you take this object and you bring down the index using the metric, it's an anti-symmetric matrix. So how many independent transformations do we have in d dimensions? The number of group elements corresponds to the number of infinitesimal transformations we can perform, the number of independent infinitesimal transformations we can perform. So we can perform as many as the number of independent elements in an anti-symmetric matrix of d dimensions, of d by d dimensions. So how many independent components we get? D times d minus 1 over 2. That's very good. How about translations? So we just take our, in the translation part, we just take our b to be infinitesimal. And that's what we get. OK? So how many we get? We get d, because we have d components. How about the scale transformations? Well, we take our lambda to be infinitesimal. And this will be the transformation. And this only bias one parameter. And our friend here, the special conformal transformations, you now take your b here to be infinitesimal as well. And you can show, right, from this piece, you get x mu d mu x squared. This is the infinitesimal part here. And expanding this times this part, you will get this piece with a minus sign. And this transformation is parameterized by four components. Or, sorry, in four dimensions, it will be four. In d dimensions, it's d. Now, what's the dimension of all this? Well, you can show that this ends up being OK? Do you know any group that has this dimension? So the question is, can all these transformations combine into a single group? Well, in order to check that, you will have to check the commutation relations of the generators and all that. But let's just try to guess what the answer is by looking at the dimension. I think it was the first tutorial, or the second tutorial, where you guys were supposed to compute the dimension of a group. What was the group? Say, what's the dimension of SOM? Do you remember? Well, it's basically the same analysis as here, right? The dimension of this group is if we want to think about this as an SOM group, what should M be? Very good, SOD plus 2. OK? Now, it turns out that this is the correct answer if we were doing, this is not quite the correct answer, OK? This has the correct dimensions, but it's not quite the correct answer. If you work out the structure of the group more carefully, you will find that if you started with a Lorentz group, okay, this was your Lorentz group, then the conformal group would end up being something of the same dimensions, but now this would be the structure. It's almost like this group. The only difference is that now the group, this group is a group of orthogonal transformations that preserve a metric that has something that looks like two times. Okay? Not one time here, but it looks like two time components. If you start with the Euclidean case, you will end up with a group that looks like SOD plus 1, comma 1. OK, very good. Sorry?
Does the second term be special?
Yes, yes. Thank you very much. The index structure. Yes, there is an X mu that I forgot. Thank you very much. Excellent. Yes, this term came from expanding the denominator for b very small. Now, b with b will be b squared, or order b squared. We don't take it. But this guy will have to combine with this one. And there will be a minus sum. OK. Now, but we're interested in what happens in two dimensions. So what happens in two dimensions? Well, let's see. Let's go back to our worksheet theory. In the gauge where the metric, the worksheet metric, was the flat metric, okay? And the coordinates were tau and sigma. Yesterday, I think, yes. So yesterday, you had to prove that the action was invariant under some special diffeomorphisms, OK? Under some special reparametrizations of the worksheet that preserved the action. And precisely those reparametrizations were the ones that send the line element to something that looks like this. So now we know that what we were doing were conformal transformations on the worksheet, right? But you also learn that anything, any transformation of the form would do the job. Now, these functions could be any functions. So we can expand them in a Taylor series, and we will get an infinite number of generators. So how come that here we only got a finite number of generators? Well, that's what's special about two dimensions. In two dimensions, a conformal group is infinite dimensional. That's the only dimension where this happens. Okay. How can we use this? This is going to be very powerful for us, right? Well, in fact, it is. The subject of studying conformal field theories in two dimensions is a big subject, very useful for condensed matter physics, and in particular for us, because the worksheet is two-dimensional. So how do we exploit this? Well, the first trick is to do a weak rotation. We send tau to be minus I tau. And what do we gain with this? Remember that our Lycon coordinates square of the form tau plus minus sigma, now they become something of this form. And this starts to look like complex coordinates and their complex conjugate. Okay? And we all know that complex numbers and complex analysis, but this is not, this would look like Z over Z, Z, Z bar. And we all know that complex analysis is very powerful because we can have the power of analytic functions. So the idea would be to do the following, to introduce the following variables, not quite these ones. We want to introduce more useful variables. Let me tell you why we want to introduce these variables. Imagine we want to describe a closed string, right? We know that we want to send this line to be equal to this line, okay? And this is the time flow. Here is time minus infinity, here is time plus infinity. Now these variables do something very interesting. They take into account that the periodicity in 0 to pi, that's why the factor of 2, with the I here, okay? And something else that is interesting is that in the new plane, in the new complex plane Z, what is the point Z equal to 0? What is the origin? What is the origin in this? What is the origin coming from in this strip? Can anyone tell me? Well, the origin is a point Z equal to 0. It must come from somewhere here, right? Excellent, tau minus infinity. So the origin comes from tau minus infinity. How about tau equals to infinity? Well, tau equals to infinity goes to infinity here, somewhere in this plane. How can we picture that? Well, imagine that we have our complex plane Z. Here is the origin. And you draw the Riemann sphere on top and define the stereographic projection, right, that maps points on the complex plane Z to points on the sphere. Now, this would be our point at infinity, and this would be our point at 0. Now, tying evolution here on the wall sheet translates into what? Into something that looks like radial evolution. Okay? So lines of equal radius correspond to lines of equal tau here. So this is now our new time evolution. Okay? How about our conformal transformations? Well, the only requirement that we had before was that if you have a function, you can define any other coordinate, Z prime, as long as it's a holomorphic function, meaning that it's only a function of Z and not a function of Z bar. Here, it translates into, or this is a statement that comes from the fact that here, sigma tilde plus could be any function of sigma plus only, not of sigma minus. Okay, and sigma bar ends up being given by this. Now, what kind of functions can we use? These are functions that are supposed to be well defined on this space. But this space, we can think about this space as being a space that has two punctures. There are two special points that we don't really care very much about, which are the origin and infinity. So our transformation can be singular there, because those points are actually at minus infinity and plus infinity. That means that we are free to choose f to have any Lorentz expansion that we want. Does anybody know what a Lorentz expansion is? Well, it's a generalization of a Taylor expansion, right? A Taylor expansion, we are all familiar with that, right? So a Lorentz expansion is an expansion that allows you to have The reason I'm writing different indices here is just for convention. Yes?
Why did you say we can use any Lorentz expansion that we want?
What I mean is that, well, not any Lorentz expansion that we can use any function that we want. It doesn't have to be, all we want is the function to be holomorphic everywhere except at 0 and infinity. OK? So holomorphic, in other words, we allow the functions to have poles at 0 and at infinity. OK? Poles of any order. That's why we have to perform a Lorentz expansion. OK? So know that if this was starting from 0, this would be the regular Taylor expansion. But now we are allowing poles at 0. Where are the poles at infinity coming from? From the positive powers, right? Positive powers will give poles at infinity. Negative powers will give poles at 0. OK. So what are the generators? Well, we just have to take these things to be infinitesimal. And we can consider each of them to be an independent transformation. Just for convention, I put a minus. People like to put a minus sign here. Okay. So now this is an infinitesimal transformation that belongs to this set. Now, can you produce this as a differential operator acting on your function? Let me call the operator ln acting on z. The answer is yes, if you define your operator to be, OK? Now, this is the operator that generates this infinitesimal transformation. Of course, we can also have the operators that will generate the same transformations on the complex conjugate variable. Now, the reason I'm calling this L is not just an accident. You can check that this differential operator satisfies an algebra which is precisely the Virasoro algebra we found before, the classical one. Moreover, it's completely obvious, right, that if you take a holomorphic and an anti-holomorphic guy, they must commute. Let me use a bar here, because it's strictly the complex conjugate. OK. But you might say, well, what's wrong with the analysis we did before for general dimension V? What is that group sitting in here? Well, in order to answer that question, I would like to ask another question, which is, which of the LMs are globally defined? On the whole sphere. Meaning that they are well defined at the origin and also at infinity. Okay? So let's first look at the origin. Okay? If we want this to be well-defined and not blow up at the origin, what do we have to impose on n? We have to impose a condition on n. If n is very negative, at the origin, we will get something that blows up, right? So in order to have something that is well-behaved at the origin, we need n to be greater or equal than, well, all we need is this power to be greater or equal than 0. Yes, minus 1. Thank you. OK, so all these operators are well-defined at the origin. How about infinity? Can anyone tell me what the condition is? Well, it's hard to tell. You see, in order to go, it's hard to tell if you're using these coordinates. In order to tell what the behavior of something is at infinity, you should go to local coordinates where infinity is a regular point. So we can introduce coordinates of this form. Now, what happens to our operator? Well, this goes into 1 over wm plus 1. Now we are asking what happens to our operators, or which operators are well-defined at w equals to 0. What happens to the differential? We also have to transform the differential, right? So the differential will become OK. Now you can check from this definition that this becomes w squared. Okay? Now our new differential, well, our old differentials, they look different. Well, how would they look like at infinity in local coordinates? They would now look like w the minus n plus 1. So what's the condition for this to be well-defined at infinity? Well, it's the condition for this to be well-defined at the origin in these new coordinates. So we need n to be, we don't want this thing to be very negative. So we need n to be less or equal than 1. Do you agree? OK. So let's put these two conditions together. We find that n must be greater or equal than minus 1, and it must be less than 1. But n can only be an integer, right? So that gives us only three possibilities. And these guys, if you look at these commutation relations, they don't mix with the other guys. So if you only consider commutation relations of those three things, you will always go back to the same three elements, okay? So they form a subgroup. And this subgroup is called SL to Z. Technically, there is a Z2 subgroup that is not realized here, so you have to mod out by SL to Z, by this Z2 subgroup. And this thing is the same, or is isomorphic, to SO3,1. Which is precisely the thing that we wanted to get from SO12,1. The conformal group would be our Euclidean group was SO2. And our conformal group will become SO3,1. OK? So that's where the analysis we did before enters here. Is precisely the ones that are globally defined give you the thing that is finite dimensional. In this case, it's only three dimensional. OK, very good. So now we can go back to physics. We were doing more or less math here. And let's look at the energy momentum tensor. So in Lycon coordinates, what are the only components that are non-zero of the energy momentum tensor? Excellent, yes. T plus plus and T minus minus. Very good. Now, what's the conservation equation for this? Remember? We can think about T as a set of currents, and this is the equation that tells us that for a given beta, this is a current that is conserved. Now, in Lycon coordinates, what does this look like? Well, let's take beta to be minus, say. So this would look like del plus T plus minus plus del minus T minus, sorry. Right. So what's wrong in this formula? Yes, yes, the metric. So if I use the metric in conform in Lycon coordinates, how do I fix this? Very good, yes. Yes, I can switch this to be minus and this to be plus, and then the equation will be correct. Right? Remember that in Lycon coordinates, the metric, the non-zero components are the off-diagonal ones. Right? But these were the only non-zero guys, so this was zero. And this is a condition we got. The same thing will happen for the plus-plus component, but now with respect to del minus. So in our complex world, what would this look like? Well, we know that this derivative will go to the derivative with respect to z. And that would mean that our object, t minus minus, would be a holomorphic function of z. And that's why we call it zz. And people just remove the indices and just write this equation. In this case, you will find sorry, I got it the other way around, right? So this doesn't depend on z. It can only depend on z bar. And therefore, we should use bar indices. And this is called t tilde. Here, this doesn't depend on z bar. That's why it has to be holomorphic, and we call this zz. Remember that the connection between the indices plus and minuses was that plus goes to z and minus goes to z bar. Okay. So we only have two functions, one holomorphic and one anti-holomorphic. Holomorphic means that it only depends on z, and it doesn't depend on z bar. OK, so at the moment, all we are doing is translating everything that we knew, yes, or everything that we built in Lycon coordinates into these new complex coordinates, yes.
Didn't you say earlier that T plus plus and T minus minus were zero?
Yes, yes. Those are conditions we have to impose, definitely.
So this is before we impose the condition?
Remember, OK, we will see the condition that these guys vanish is a condition that all their when we span this in a Taylor series now, or when we span this in a Lorentz series, the condition will be that all the coefficients have to vanish. Right? That's what we found before, right? When we expanded them in a Fourier mode decomposition, we set all the coefficients or the Fourier modes to be zero. What were the Fourier modes? Yes, excellent. OK? So some friends we met before we now look like this. Okay, in complex coordinates. And indeed, we want to expand this in a Lorentz expansion now. And the coefficients will be our friends. Okay? So this is just translation, okay, from the old language to the new language. Sorry? The T and the T bar?
D and D bar.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes, before I was writing them explicitly, right? But this is shorter, right? So that's why people like to write this. Okay. Thank you. Okay, very good. Now we're doing a field theory in two dimensions, and in a theory where we have the conformal group acting nicely. And therefore, our fields, or the fields we're going to consider, should also transform nicely. And we're going to consider fields that transform as follows. So if you take any transformation of this form, which is a conformal transformation, we want to consider fields that behave like this. These are conformal fields of conformal dimension H tilde. Okay? So this is just, this is the name we give to any field that transforms like this under conformal transformations. Just like we call a tensor that has two indices and is symmetric, a rank two symmetric tensor, just to tell how it transforms under Lorentz transformations. Here we say that a field that transforms like this is called a field of conformal dimension H and H tilde. Infinitesimally, what happens? Well, if you take an infinitesimal transformation of the form we studied before, right? Let's just denote it like epsilon z. It could be any of the ones we did before, right? With any power. You consider any of those. Then the transformation of the field, of this field, is in fact computed as a contour integral with the energy momentum tensor of the theory. Now, I don't expect you to understand carefully what this definition means. It's actually tricky. You have to define it properly. In a sense, I have to tell you carefully what the contour of integration means. The only reason I wrote this formula here is because I want to motivate the following. You see that a contour integral in the complex plane only receives contributions from where? From poles. Which kind of poles? When can we get a non-zero answer? Double poles, triple poles, simple poles? What's that? All of them. So if you have the integral around z equal to 0, so dz over z squared, what is this integral? Yeah. Excellent. Very good. So only simple poles. Now, what that means is that in order to understand the behavior in the theory, all we have to understand is what happens when these operators become very, very close to each other, which are the only places where we can develop singularities, right? So in a quantum theory, when you have operators and they happily live far away from each other, it's very hard to produce. You don't expect to have any singularities arising. Only when the operators, when quantum operators are coming very, very close to each other, you would expect to have singularities, okay? And those are the singularities that will contribute to this contour integral. And that motivates the study of something that are called operator product expansions. I think you guys have seen that, right? In four dimensions. These are called OPEs. So what's the idea? Well, the idea is that even though we know that these operators will become singular, will develop singularities as they come very, very close to each other, the idea is that whatever the singularity is must be also governed by the fields in the theory. So you should be able to expand or to model the behavior very, very, when the two fields are coming very, very close to each other in terms of also the fields in the theory. Okay? So let me give you an example. By looking at this object and looking at the energy momentum tensor, one can show explicitly that if you have these two operators and you want to understand what the behavior is when z goes very, very close to w, this operator is dominated by the following. Plus terms that are non-singular in the limit. Okay? So for all our purposes, or next week's purposes, all you need to know is the singular behavior. And it's very useful to learn how to compute OPEs. Now, the same thing will happen if you take the OPE of T tilde with phi. Now you will get H tilde. Okay. Now, there is a nice exercise in the book that I encourage you to go through. It's done in the book. So the exercise is to compute the OPE of our friends okay, and to show that this is equal to 1/4 eta mu nu over and the way you do this is that you look at this side and you say, well, somehow the most singular piece seems to be a C number. It doesn't seem to be an operator. Okay? So if you suspect that and you want to compute the most singular piece, what you can do is to compute the expectation value of this operator, meaning you put it inside brackets with a vacuum. You expand this in oscillator modes and just perform the whole sums. And you will find a series that will sum up to this times 0, 0. But this is normalized to be 1. And therefore, you will find the structure you were looking for. So this is a very instructive exercise to do. OK. I think it's also in the book. The OPE of the energy momentum tensor with itself. Now, if somebody hands you an operator, a way of telling if the operator is a conformal operator, and to compute the weights is precisely to compute the OPEs of the operator with the energy momentum tensor. Okay? That's what people usually say, or what people usually do. If you're handed any random operator, and you want to check whether the operator is a conformal operator, and to compute its dimensions, you ask, well, give me the energy momentum tensor of the theory, and I'll compute for you the OPEs and check that this structure is satisfied. Now, if I give you the energy momentum tensor as your operator, how would you tell if the energy momentum tensor is a conformal operator or not? Do we have to compute the OPE of the energy momentum tensor with whom? With itself. Excellent. So we have to check that this has the same structure as this. But now you can do exactly the same thing here. And you will find that there is a piece that is a C number. In fact, it shows a C number that is called C half. This was meant to be a joke. Sorry. Now you see, if only this C was 0, you would get that the energy momentum tensor would also be a conformal operator of conformal dimension 2, or conformal dimension 2,0, if you wish to write everything. Usually, for holomorphic fields, you only write H or H tilde, because the other one is obviously 0 all the time, right? Now, what is this C for our theory? This C is the same C that enters in the conformal anomaly that we found, or that we talk about, that modifies the Virasoro algebra. Remember, we had the Virasoro algebra, very nice algebra. And then we said that in the quantum theory, it develops an anomaly, right? And that anomaly is controlled by this number C, which is also called the conformal anomaly. Now, in our theory where we had x mu and we had d of them, it turns out that the conformal anomaly in that theory is equal to d. Each of the x coordinates contributes one unit to c. Okay, so each of these bosons, each of these scalar fields, is contributing one unit to d. Now, next week, you will find some other kind of objects. And you can just try to do it yourselves. If you have now a Fermi field, okay, one can compute the OPE of the field with itself and also the field with the energy momentum tensor now in the theory that is modified by adding these Fermi fields, okay? Remember, when we talk about the energy momentum tensor, we talk about the energy momentum tensor of a given theory. So you have to ask first, well, give me the action. And from there, I compute the energy momentum tensor. And then I compute the OPEs with any operator you like. Now, from that computation, you find that the contribution to the conformal anomaly of these fields for each of them, so let me just write one of them, for each of them is a half. Okay? In this case, for each of them, we had one. So we can say here that we had the sum of all of them gave us t. OK, now that we're discussing this, let me use the opportunity to mention that something we didn't do, but which is a way that most people quantize theories nowadays, right, is using a path integral approach. Now, what's the problem with the path integral? With the path integral defining our theory at the moment? We had the path integral where we have to integrate over all metrics, over all x configurations of the action. So is this path integral well defined? No, it's not. Why is it not well defined? Sorry? Yes. We have an infinite dimensional redundancy, right? So the same physical configuration is described by many, many, many things that are that have no physical meaning. So we have a big redundancy. And that redundancy will make this ill-defined, even more so than what mathematicians would say the path integral is ill-defined. So mathematicians, even after gauge fixing, will say that it's not well-defined. Well, in two dimensions, I think that there's been progress in making it rigorously well-defined, but certainly not in four dimensions. And for that, there is a $1 million prize that you can also try to start working on. And so what I want to say is that, well, OK, right? So we have to divide by the volume. I mean, the way to remind ourselves that we have to do something is to divide by the volume of that invariance, or the group of invariances or redundancies that we have. And this volume is infinite, and it's supposed to regulate this. But of course, this doesn't buy us anything. This is only, these are only symbols. And the way we fix this is using, of course, the Fadyev Popov technique. Okay? And when we do that, in this case, we're going to introduce the Fadyev Popov Gauss. And it turns out that we have two of them. It's kind of unlucky that this one is called C, and we have C all over the place, but well, what can be done? They are called B and C. And it turns out that they have conformal dimensions, 2 and minus 1. Okay. Now you can have your new theory with the Fadyev Popov Gauss included. Compute the energy momentum tensor and ask, what is the contribution of these guys to the conformal anomaly of the total energy momentum tensor? And it turns out that the contribution from the from this BC system, as it's called, just turns out to be, for no reason whatsoever, minus 26. Now, if you want your theory to be conformal invariant and not have a conformal anomaly, you have to require that the sum of all the central charges vanishes. So if you only had the oscillators, the guys were contributing a total of D to C, right? So the total central charge would be the sum over all the contributions from the coordinates x, from the x scalar fields, plus the contribution from our Fadyev Popov Gauss. And we want this to be 0. OK. Well, but next week you will also see something more interesting, which is that in order to have space-time fermions, you have to include fermions on the Wolf shape. and these are these guys. And a nice way of doing it, well, of course, we will have to introduce one for each space-time dimension. So we'll have one of these ones and one of these ones, right? So we will now have, when we do the superstring, we will have a contribution from the X guys and a contribution from the fermions. Okay. Now this one contributes a 1, this one contributes a 1/2, and this is 3/2. And we have D of them. So the contribution from these guys turns out to be 3/2 times D. Okay? Of course, we also have our Fayev-Popov cost of Weil and Diffios, which were contributing minus 26. But we will also find that there is a corresponding fermionic analog of Weil and Diffios. We will also have to gauge fix that using a Fayev-Popov trick again, introducing Fayev-Popov cos again for those guys. And the new system of Fayev-Popov cos are going to contribute the new super guys. They turn out to contribute plus 11. And we want this to be 0. So this could have been, it could have been anything. I mean, it didn't have to be the solution to this equation didn't have to be an integer. But as you can see, we get quite nicely. Very good. So this is just a preview of what's going to happen next week. But let me introduce something that is very important for us, which is called the state operator correspondence. Remember that the origin in our complex plane Z was very special. What was the meaning of that point in terms of the time flow? Do you remember? This point in terms of tau minus infinity. Infinite past, right? So if you take an operator acting on the vacuum, and you take the limit when z goes to 0, we interpret the state that you produce as being equivalent to a physical state that is inserted at minus infinity. Okay? So for every operator, we can define a state, and that's called the state operator correspondence. Just trying to see. So we have 10 more minutes, I guess. Well, going along these lines, this is something that perhaps that you guys will have to study when you get to learn more about Lie groups and Lie algebras, when you get to learn about representations, okay? I would advise you to learn first about representations of finite dimensional groups before you start studying representations of infinite dimensional groups. The conformal group is an infinite dimensional group. And then what is nice about the physical states that we were defining, that we defined yesterday, is that these physical states will give you a representation of this infinite dimensional group. Okay? So those are the words. But the words will mean something more once you learn representations of finite groups. So so that would be more useful once you learned Lie groups more properly and you study representations. But I think we now know enough to do something interesting, which is from the spectrum we computed yesterday, we learned that in the closed string sector, we found three kind of states that had zero mass. Can anyone remind me what the states were? Do you remember how we got them? We got them in the Lycon gauge, right? So we were only looking at the transfer directions. We found these guys by looking how they transform under the Lie group. And the guys came from here, right? And we found three guys. We found a rank 2 symmetric traceless tensor. We found a rank 2 anti-symmetric tensor. And we had the trace, which ended up being a scalar field. OK? All of them massless. So we can ask, in space-time, what happens when you put many, many of these fields together and you form a coherent state of these fields? It turns out that you can change your background from the flat Minkowski space that we had into something else. In this case, we're familiar with what's going to happen, right? If you put many of these guys together, you can change your space-time geometry into something that will have a metric. Okay? Because this guy was nothing but the graviton. Our friend here can produce a field in space-time that is anti-symmetric. This is nothing but a two-form. We can build a two-form in space-time called B. And this one produces a scalar field. Okay. Now, we learned during this week how the string behaves in a flat space-time. So what would be the string action if we didn't have a flat space-time, but we had a metric at metric different from the Minkowski metric, we also had a background where we had a two-form B field and a scalar. Well, the answer is the following. It's almost as simple as we can imagine. Before we had the space-time, the flat space-time metric here. Now all we are going to do is to replace it by now this thing here means dz dz bar. Okay? Now, note that this is a very complicated theory in general, right? Is this a free theory even after we perform the, even after we go to the gauge where the wall sheet metric is the flat Minkowski metric? Remember, before, when we set H to be eta, the X fields only had a kinetic term. They didn't interact with each other. It was a free theory. So all what we did this week was only to do a free field theory in two dimensions. But now the metric here this space-time metric depends on x. It can be a very complicated function of x. In particular, it can have many, many powers of x here. So now the x field is not free anymore. How do we define the action of the how the string will couple to the B field? Well, all we have to do is to take, we have these two forms in spacetime. We just have to find the pullback of the two forms onto the wall sheet. And that is defined by this quantity. OK. Now, there is a very beautiful physical interpretation of this. And you probably have seen something, the analog of this for a point particle. So if you have a point particle that has an electric charge Q and propagates in the background of an electromagnetic field, what is the action that you write? Remember, the action is so this is the analog of this action. And it's telling us that the string can produce this field because it's one of the states there. And therefore, it can also couple to it. And this is the way it couples. Yes.
What do you mean by pullback?
What do I mean by?
Pullback.
The pullback. OK. Yes, I thought. Well. If you have a map from one manifold to another manifold, right, you can also define canonically a map that takes any form on the image and bring it and produces a form on the domain. And that map is called the pullback. Okay? But if you're not familiar with the pullback, don't worry about it. I wrote all the indices. So this is all it means. Okay? Now, finally, and this is the final thing we will do today, let's write down what happens to the dilaton. Oh, yes, I forgot to say that this is called the dilaton. Okay. Now remember, we wrote this action, right, without phi here. The very first day we wrote this action. Why didn't we study this part of the action? Or didn't we? Did we? Didn't we? It depends. I think we did study this part of the action. So what was the conclusion? Well, it's not that it's zero. It's just that it doesn't modify the dynamics, right? And why did it modify the dynamics? Well, now assume, let's go back to that case. Assume that phi of x is a constant. So we can pull it out of here. What did we say about this? We said that this didn't contribute to the dynamics because it was a topological invariant. It ends up computing a topological property of the manifold you are considering. Okay. So what's the manifold in this case? In the simplest case, it's a sphere. And this object computes what is called the Euler characteristic of the sphere, in our case here. Okay. So what do we find? We find that if our wall sheet turns out to be a sphere, like in this case, the contribution of a constant dilaton, well, first I have to tell you what the Euler characteristic would be for a sphere. Well, for the sphere, it turns out to be 2. Okay, I'll tell you what it is more generally in a second. But then what we find is that the action, our path integral, that will now have the sum of the three actions. Okay, this part of the action will give us an overall factor that is of the form e minus 2 phi. Okay, this will be the overall factor that comes from performing this path integral on this world sheet. But we want to define the analog of, in field theory, of a perturbation expansion. In the very first lecture, we talk about what happens when strings come and interact, right? We said that they can produce, the open strings can come, interact for a while, split, come back again, and split again, and do crazy things. Now, it turns out that in the case of the closed string, the guys that are coming to interact can be represented by points on the sphere. And this would be what in field theory is called the three-level amplitude, or the three-level approximation. The one-loop approximation would be when you consider a world sheet that looks like a torus. And there, the Euler characteristic happens to be 0. A two-loop contribution would be something that looks like this. Free loop, you can imagine what it is. It turns out that in two dimensions, oriented compact manifolds are classified by the number of handles that you have on the manifold. And that exhausts the whole classification, right? That's a very important theorem. It's a very deep result that in two dimensions, the classification of manifolds, of orientable compact manifolds, is very, very simple. It's only given by the Euler characteristic. And the Euler characteristic is 2 times minus 2 times the number of handles. By a handle, we mean the ways you can wrap the Riemann surface. So here we have no way of doing it. We have 0 handles. We have one way. Here we have 2 handles, 3 handles, and so on. Now, this starts to look like a perturbation expansion. And the perturbation expansion is controlled by the value of the dilaton. And therefore, the string coupling will be related to the value of the dilaton. OK? You will see this more next week, so let's not worry about this. So let's end with a comment that I think is very amusing, just to make the comment. In quantum field theory, remember that when we want to define scattering amplitudes, we usually define scattering amplitudes of plane waves, right? So what is a plane wave that carries momentum k mu? Well, we define the wave function of a plane wave to be e to the I k dot x. Now, for our strings, we would like to do something similar. So we would like to find a conformal operator that looks like this. And it turns out that if you define this guy to be e to the k dot x, this is a conformal operator of the corresponding dimension to correspond to a physical state in the string, in the string, if k squared happens to be 2, which means that this is a tachyon. And what's the meaning of this operator? If you insert this operator in your theory, in your path integral, the meaning of this is that you are inserting a physical state or a string with this momentum And in this state, so I don't expect you to understand all these words, but all I want to make is the following statement, that a scattering amplitude in a space-time, which is a very cool statement, I think, a scattering amplitude in a space-time is given by what you do is you put these are called vertex operators. And this is what I represented by these x's on the worksheet. And what you do is that you take the path integral, you put these operators inside, and you compute the correlation function of these vertex operators and I'll conclude with this statement that scattering amplitudes in space-time are computed from correlation functions in the Wall-Sheet theory. Okay. I find this statement fascinating. And I think that it's a very, very deep statement. And you will find something similar to this in 2 weeks. I hope you will be able to recognize and remember when you see it. It will not be related to this context. That's a clue. Also, in 2 weeks, the new course that you're going to start in the explorations will also provide for you the answer to the question I posed at the end of the first lecture, which was, well, at least my interpretation of my answer to that thing, which was, could it be that string theory was really physics of the 21st century that was just discovered in the 1970s in an attempt to describe the strong interactions? Okay. So I'll close with those two things. Remember this connection here, and try to find it in the next course. In 2 weeks, that will start in 2 weeks, and try to also find if my statement or the statement that Amati made makes any sense in the light of what you're going to learn in 2 weeks. Okay? So let me stop here. Any questions? No questions? Okay. Let me just say that Catherine Becker, one of the authors of the book, is coming on Sunday, and she will precisely start where I ended. So she will start with a superstring, most likely in the Lycon gauge, and you will recompute the dimension of the space-time. Okay, so you will see that again. All right. Okay. Thank you.